This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Inside Story on BFM 89.9.
Good evening, this is Inside Story with Lee Chui Lin. Tonight, it's our Merdeka special, where we look at what the next chapter holds for our country and ask, what will Malaysia look like in 20 years? So we'll be examining this first from the economy and talking about how it could be more inclusive. And then we look at how our education system could change and develop. And finally, how will our culture and identity shift in 20 years? Who will we be in 2040? We want to hear from you. If we jump 20 years ahead, what would you like Malaysia to be like in 2040? Call us 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. This is Inside Story. It is 6:07, and as we all know, tomorrow is going to be the 64th Merdeka Day, Hari Merdeka. And on the station, across the station, we've been exploring what the next chapter holds for Malaysia. We wanted something that would be a little bit more forward-looking, partly because the past 2 years have been really difficult, really turbulent. Between the pandemic and political instability, there hasn't really been a lot of breathing room to step back and think about what the future of our country could look like. So that's the idea behind today's show. We want to take a moment, reset, and look forward and ask what you would like to see in our country in the next 20 years, whether it's how our economy and education systems could change or really how where we'll be culturally. Because I think it is worth saying that we chose these angles very specifically, partly because they're all tied together, right? And our economy, we're going to be looking at it more closely in terms of how it can be more inclusive, in terms of social safety nets, in terms of the kinds of reforms we need to see, what we've learned from the last 64 years or the last 2 years for that matter. And when it comes to education, every time we talk about anything at all really to do with our country and whether our national identity is a strong one, whether we are competitive in the general landscape of the world, education is the thing that always comes up. Everyone wants to know whether we're doing enough in that area, whether we are keeping up to date, whether we're going to improve. So that's why we're going to be looking at that. And then culture and identity, because everything we talk about, one critique always comes back to how much of a dog whistle in some ways, how quickly we react to things around race and religion. So I think we wanted to look at it more broadly and examine what the Malaysian cultural identity could look like. But as mentioned, we are going to be starting off with the economy. And we'd love to hear from you. What do you want from Malaysia in 2040? What would you like it to be like? That number to call is 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. In the meantime, we're joined by Emeritus Professor Dr. Norma Manso, Director at the Social Wellbeing Research Centre of University Malaya. So Prof, thank you so much for joining us. As mentioned, we're talking about our economy. So to start off, what state of economy should we be aspiring towards as a country 20 years from now?
Hi, and thank you for having me. It's a pleasure speaking with you again. 20 years. It's not just about 20 years when we're talking about the economy. It is a journey. It can be for 20 years and beyond. Yeah, we should always aspire to do better and be able to sustain what we have achieved. And with the pandemic, with the COVID-19 pandemic, we have we were badly affected. Yeah, in 2020, we had a negative growth of 5.6%. And the prospect or the forecast for 2021 is better, but it's not as good as what we have expected because of the pandemic that has worsened, yeah, over the last month or more than 6 months now. Yeah. So that has slowed our growth. Now, what I would like to see would be a Malaysia that is developed and competitive and whose people enjoy a high quality of life and high level of income resulting from growth that is both inclusive and sustainable. Yeah. So it's an aspiration, I think, post Vision 2020 is about shared prosperity. It's about not leaving anyone behind. So when you talk about a developed nation, it is a nation that has got a good infrastructure everywhere you go, good healthcare. Yeah, it doesn't matter where you live, and everyone has the opportunity to better their lives. So that will be the aspiration in the next 10, 20 or beyond, and to be able to sustain the kind of living standard, the quality of life that I mentioned earlier.
So can you talk to us more about inclusivity and what it would mean to have an inclusive economy?
An inclusive economy is an economy that would give equal opportunity to everyone, not just providing the opportunity, but also supporting Malaysians, in general, to achieve what they were hoping and aspire to be. Also, an inclusive society would mean a society that respects everyone's rights. So it is about human rights. It is about getting everyone to be protected, everyone to feel safe, and everyone to feel that when they are facing a crisis such as our pandemic or any crisis in their life, that they feel that they will not be left alone. They are they have their savings, for instance, to begin with. But as a society, we also have to ensure that in order to save, people will have to make a living. And also, the policy has to be there to support that the savings that they have grow. The savings that they have will get into investment, and that will create the kind of growth and the kind of opportunities that others can have or can enjoy in the economy that is the results of the fruits of the development.
And what are the building blocks that we need to achieve that aspiration?
Number one, I think we have to address the structural issues that we are facing. You will talk about a better quality education that will ensure that there are better quality jobs out there. So it works both ways, the demand side and the supply side. Is the education that would enable our children to participate in high value added type of sectors. But we do have structural issues that jobs that's created in Malaysia do not necessarily yield higher income. So you would also have to encourage industries. You would have to encourage or get industries to upgrade themselves, to be involved in high value-added activities. We can't rely on cheap labor, on our abundant resources anymore, because people are not happy when the prices are higher, and yet their income is low. So it does not guarantee a better living standard when people cannot consume their daily needs. So there need to be policies that would support this kind of industries, that would incentivize industries that can innovate, that can upgrade the technology. I mean, we have issues with COVID-19 when you talk about our foreign workers. The over-reliance on foreign workers were because we were focusing on having industries with less technology that is doing the kind of work that we were doing 30, 40 years ago. So we have not, our policies have not changed fast enough in order to encourage higher income or higher value-added factories or economic activities to come to our country. So see, these are some of the structural issues that we have to work, where the low income are the large majority of Malaysians now. And hopefully, with the recovery going forward and with our aspiration, with the Merdeka Day, that we can look forward to something better.
We're speaking today with Emeritus Professor Datuk Dr. Norma Mansor about what Malaysia's economy could be in 2040. We'll be back with more after this, and we'd love to hear from you. What would you like to see in Malaysia in 2040? You can call us 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. We will be continuing this conversation on Inside Story. Keep it here, BFM 89.9.
Bring forth Moolah, BFM 89.9.
It is 6:17 and you're listening to Inside Story with Lynn. Our Merdeka special today is focused on looking at what our country could be in the next chapter. And we want to hear from you. what would you like to see in Malaysia in 2040? So we're leaping 19, 20 years ahead. You can call us 7733-2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. And now we're continuing our conversation with Emeritus Professor Datuk Dr. Norma Mansor about how Malaysia's economy could change in 2040. So Prof, earlier we were talking about the building blocks that we need. And as always, as we try to look forward, we also need to look back. Over the last 64 years, what are some lessons that economists and policymakers have learned along the way?
Policies cannot be static. We have passed or gone were the years where you're talking about high growth, and high growth are dependent upon our natural resources, our cheap labor. Yeah, our policies has to be supporting and promoting industries that will capitalize, or that they are able to utilize our well-educated citizens, educated Malaysians. So inviting labor-intensive or encouraging foreign labor into Malaysia is not the way to go anymore. So our people too will have to be able to be upskilled, and I think they are ready to be upskilled. And so policies have to be agile. It's easier said than done, because there are a lot of vested interests as well. Yeah, in my work, in my past work, the work that I did a decade ago, there are vested interests that would want to do business as usual because they benefited from this practices. Yeah, so why change when it ain't broken for them? Yeah, so but as an economy, we have to revise. We have to reform. Going forward on what do we want for our country. And we have to be willing to bite the bullet. And maybe it can only happen with a strong political will. Otherwise, there will be a lot of detractors out there, and they are as strong, if not stronger, than people who are willing to change or who would support change.
And would you say our needs have shifted in the last six decades?
Oh, yes, we have. And I think citizens everywhere, not just Malaysians, I think as the country progresses, people are more educated, more exposed, and they're more aware of their rights. They would demand more from a government. And you talk about infrastructure, and now people are talking about 5G. That is very important now, And we have rolled out in some parts, but Malaysia is not just about big cities. Malaysia is a big country. Yeah, it's talking about East Malaysia. Yeah, are there enough industries in this part of Malaysia? So if they are not, this is what we're talking. When we talk about relative poverty, it's not about the income that our, my generation, the newer generation, it will not be the level of income and the inflation had gone many folds. Yeah. So it's not about that anymore. It's about other things as well. Yeah. It's about being able to avail themselves to better education. Yeah. To avail themselves to better living, no longer a small flat with four or five people within a small space. Now, the other factor or the other dimension that we have to look at is our aging population, which is happening very rapidly. Yeah. So are we prepared? Are our seniors prepared with their savings, number one, and healthcare facilities for an aging population? So more things are coming into the fore when we are talking about 20 years from now. You're talking about two decades where Malaysia is easily an aged, Malaysia has an aged population. So this is the kind of scenarios that we are looking at.
And of course, we've also been grappling with the pandemic for the past year and a half. What lessons did we learn in that time?
Well, number one, I think when the pandemic happens, I think everyone was caught, that we didn't even know where were our poor, but we were fast I would have to congratulate not just the government, but the NGOs, the religious organizations, civil society, neighbors, community. I think they all came together to improve on the names and context of people who are poor, who needed the support. Yeah. So I think that the biggest lesson that we learned is, of course, number one, is to know who needs help. Yeah. Who needed help and who needs help. So that is when good databases would help. And the other key point that I would like to make is that often you hear people say that make hay while the sun shines, you know. I was reminded by an economist 10 years ago when we were talking about Malaysia not having a strong social policy, that he reminded us that if you want to look at social policy, social protection, it should be when during good times. Yeah, but unfortunately, we didn't prepare ourselves. Yeah, it is, of course, this is unprecedented, but we do not want every crisis to be unprecedented. We did something post the Asian financial crisis. We established the employment insurance system. So that's a passive labor market policy. But at least we were able to grow that fund, yeah, and that was able to support some of the people who belong to the formal sector. But for those who are self-employed, who are in the informal sector, then many of them did not have much savings or no savings at all, yeah. So these are some of the things that has taught us a lesson, and it's a very, very difficult lesson that we learn. But if you don't learn from here, then we will never learn. Now, you have orphans, children of parents who have died due to COVID. If we don't have child grant, what will happen to these children? So it's about time that we adopt the life cycle approach or the social protection, that the social protection floor. Yeah, I propose that all Malaysians, once you reach a certain age, maybe at the age of 15, because some kids work at the age of 15, should belong to a national social protection system that when they start earning, they should contribute to the social security fund or social insurance fund according to their affordability. And social insurance will have that cross-subsidization where the richer will support the poorer. Yeah. So in a society, we as a society is judged from how we treat our weaker ones or poorer ones in a society. So you look at a developed society and you can see how they are willing to contribute because they know that this contribution will help the other section of the society who are not able to earn, don't have the earning power as they do, even for their daily consumption. Or when they are in need. So I would propose that we relook, yeah, we reform. We have the Malaysian Social Protection Council. I'm part of that as well. I hope we will revitalize and we look at this again. The Prime Minister is the chairman of the Social Protection Council and look at our proposal again, yeah, because in the team we have the relevant agencies as well as the Bank Negara, the KWSP, yeah, the EPF, and also SOCSO and other agencies as well. So we are supporting the Malaysia Social Protection in that regard. Yeah.
Now, earlier you mentioned the need for strong political will to change how we look at the economy. What would it take to generate that political will?
I think the political will is to ensure that our policies are suitable for the current times. Yeah, I suggested that industries or the economy, it should not be the old engine. It cannot be the business as usual. Yeah, hence, the social protection comes in handy because social protection is not just about reducing inequality or it's not just about addressing poverty, but it is also about human capital. Yeah, so people are more willing to take risks if they feel that if something happens to them, if they lose their job, their family will be able to eat for the next 6 months while they're looking for a job. Yeah. So having the right support, yeah, not to disincentivize people from going out to get jobs, but to provide them support while they are looking for jobs. Yeah? We do not want someone who just would plod along because they are in a job of 2,000 ringgit a month or 1,500 ringgit a month because they are afraid that if they cannot find another job, then they will be, their families are at risk. They're not able to eat. Yeah. So they should be able to upgrade themselves. Yeah. The industry will also have to incentivize people who have the extra skill. So an X amount of months for you to get the certificate for the kind of training, but you will get an X amount of extra income. Yeah. So the political will is about changing not just one, but this, the whole ecosystem, the whole system, they're all interlinked. But I do public policy as well. It is not easy to change policies. It's not as fast as the industry. Yeah. So I would suggest that our civil servants would also have to learn as fast and get the policies in order to get the right incentives. I mean, the idea is the regulation is also to give the message that this is the incentive for you to be educated and for industries to get people with the right skills to perform the job. I mean, these are some of the characteristics that we are talking about of a high-income economy.
Prof, thank you so much for speaking with us. That was Emeritus Professor Datuk Dr. Norma Manso, Director at the Social Wellbeing Research Centre of University Malaya, discussing what our economy could be in 2040 and how it could be more inclusive. And this is in line with our Insight Story special today, where we're looking at essentially what the next chapter holds for Malaysia. We'd love to hear from you. What do you want Malaysia to be like in 20 years' time, in 2040? Call us 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio.
Building fit Malaysians, BFM 89.9.
It is 6:38 and you're listening to Inside Story with Lynn. It is our Merdeka special today, where we are looking at what the next chapter could hold for our country and interpreting that by looking at what Malaysia could be in 2040. So in line with that, we've been asking you that very question. We want to know, what do you want Malaysia to be like in 2040? What would you like to see from us? You can call 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at BFM Radio. We do have some messages that have already come in, but we do. I wanted to focus on this one from Ravi, who says, hopefully, discipline and kita jaga kita is included in the national syllabus. And that's, I think a pretty nice setup for our next segment, because earlier we spoke about the economy and now we want to talk about education. And joining us to do that is Chan Sun Sing, CEO of Teach for Malaysia. Sun Sing, as always, thanks for taking the time to speak with us.
Thanks for having me, Lynn. It's good to be here.
So let's start with that very question, right? What would you like the education system in Malaysia to look like in 20 years' time? What fundamental changes or growth would you like to see?
Yeah, so I mean, at Teach for Malaysia, what our vision is to see an education system where every child gets access to quality education, no matter what their background is. And we know that that's not the case today. And there are many lines of divide, you know, the economic divide, the urban-rural divide, and now with the COVID-19 pandemic, the digital divide are holding kids back. And ultimately, what we want to see is that every kid, no matter what background they're from, you could send your kid to any public school in the country, and as a parent, feel guaranteed that they're going to have the kind of education that is going to set them up to fulfill their potential in life. What does that look like, right? And so, you know, we believe that an education needs to be an education that sets a student up to be a leader of their own learning, of their future, and ultimately the future of this nation. And so I think, you know, we really need to shift away from the very singular academic focus of our education system. and, you know, all across the world is looking towards the, you know, these buzzwords like 21st century skills, 21st century learning. And, you know, we're 21 years into the 21st century, right? And what does that mean for us, right? And, you know, when we think about the holistic skills that kids need, we're not going to be able to predict the content and the knowledge, but can we equip kids with skills? And so ultimately, you know, what we really believe matters is teachers. You know, the quality of an education system cannot exceed the quality of its teachers. And we believe that, you know, when we bring in the most amazing teachers into our schools, into our classrooms, the most passionate, talented, most vibrant and inspiring people in our classrooms, we believe that that will shift and make a huge difference.
So I want to get to that in a bit, right? Just to talk about what kinds of steps we need to take to get to that shift. But a personal gripe of mine, I suppose, is our examination focus. And we know, right, our system has been so based in exams for a long time. Do you think this needs adapting?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think that there's nothing inherently wrong with an exam. But the issue is that our examinations in Malaysia are taken as sort of the end all and be all of education. You know, societally, we equate education to examinations. You get an education when you get a string of A's at the end of the day. But the reality is that, you know, written academic examinations cannot fully measure the learning of a child. And I think that there's a couple of things that we need to sort of change in the way that we see education and examinations as a society, because it's not just the thing that the Ministry of Education actually is trying to shift away from this exam-oriented approach. But as a society, we're so programmed, whether it's parents, whether it is employers, we're so programmed to think of examinations as the thing that helps you determine the quality of an education system. And so I think there's a couple of things to think about. First, we have to recognize that there are many, 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 many more ways to assess a child than a written examination, and especially with technology today, we can do so much more. And so there are performance-based assessments, project-based assessments. Kids can create portfolios. Kids can create prototypes. Kids can create apps. They can create software, podcasts, YouTube videos. There's so many more ways to assess a child, and technology can enable us to make that assessment effective and to validate that assessment to ensure that that is something that is truly created and authentic. The second thing is that we have to recognize that we have to measure more than just academics. So the written examinations, you know, have they're efficient in the sense that it can measure academics to quite effectively. But if we want a holistic education that is enabling our students to develop skills, the 21st century skills, creativity, collaboration, critical thinking, communication skills, then that isn't necessarily written examinations aren't necessarily going to be the best forms. So the second thing is we need to realize that, you know, if we want to measure holistically, we have to go beyond written examinations.
So we've seen technology playing a really huge role in education over the last year and a half, perhaps more than ever before. How do you see it integrating further into our classroom?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the one, you know, there are very few things that are positive about this pandemic, but one of the positive things is that so many more kids, although there are many, many, many kids that don't have access, so many more kids are going to have access to technology as a result of the need that the pandemic has shown a light on. You know, the Ministry of Finance and the Ministry of Education have invested in devices for kids, and they're going to continue to do that over the next few years. So like I said, right, I think technology has the power to transform the way that we assess students' learning and knowledge, because we're then going to be able to capture that and store all of that information in a way that is accessible to the teacher, to the student, and to the parents across the schooling life cycle of a child. The other thing that technology enables or has enabled at this point in time is it's made teachers into much more effective content creators. And so the ability for a child to access content that is related to what they are passionate about studying or what they're struggling to study will be so much higher now because of all of the content that's being created over this time. So if we can give access, so it will give kids more quality of content as well as an ability to track back and have more meaningful assessments.
So if I take you back to your first answer, right, which looked at this idea of a holistic education, a focus on teachers, and this idea of imbuing kids with leadership skills, what steps are needed to get us to that vision?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, ultimately, we need to invest in leadership at every level across the Ministry of Education, across our education system. You know, I already said that with our students, we've got to develop that in their schooling experience, develop their leadership, the competencies of leadership, right? Not just the positions. I'm the head prefect, therefore I'm a leader. No, it's about the competencies. Can you influence positively? But at the same level, we need to empower at every level. So teachers need to be given a voice. Teachers need to be able to be creative. They need to lead. School leaders need more authority and more autonomy to make decisions about how their schools are run and how their schools are governed. So I think a key thing is that currently the Ministry of Education is very centrally governed. So that means that if someone makes a decision at the top, that decision has to be followed through at every level. But what we actually need to do is flip that around and give the autonomy and the authority to the people who are closest to the challenges, closest to the issues, to come up with the solutions that make the most sense to the kids and to the communities that they're serving. And so it's a very broad answer, but really, like, ultimately that will be the key to shift everything, because the Ministry of Education has all the right plans. They've got all the right policies. They've got access to all the right information and have access to the largest budget of any ministry in our country. And so ultimately, it's increasing the quality of leadership at every single level of the system.
And as you alluded to, I think even now we see gaps opening up between different types of schools in our country, whether it's, you know, between public schools and private or international institutions. What can we do to ensure that these gaps don't continue to widen over the next two decades?
Yeah, so I mean, I think that it's going to be extremely important. You know, like I said earlier, at Teach for Malaysia, we believe in equity, and we believe that it should be about meeting the needs of the kids who have the highest needs. And I think that needs to be how we view all of our policy decision-making. When we think about the education system, how are we ensuring that we're investing in the students and the communities that have the highest need first? And so, you know, traditionally, when we take a performance-based approach, it's been like the schools that are high performing get access to better teachers, get access to potentially more funding, and then get access to students who have performed better academically. And so you then create this vicious cycle of those at the top continuing to do better and better, and those, quote unquote, at the other end of the spectrum being left out. And so as a system, we really need to take an equity-based focus and really ensure that our policies are designed to meet the needs of kids with the highest needs. And it's not about equality. It's not making sure that every kid has the same level of resources. In fact, kids from low income backgrounds probably need more resources than a kid from a higher income background. So how do we shift that away and then get our top performing schools to be working directly with our lowest performing schools to ensure that excellence is then being spread in a way that it is meeting the needs of those with the highest needs?
Sinsing, we just have a minute left with you. Would you like to leave us with a wish for Merdeka?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we say that when we empower our children, we empower Malaysia. And, you know, education is a key to empowering anyone to discover their passions and their potential. And, you know, we believe that it is an all of society effort to ensure that our kids have access to the education that we need. So my wish for Merdeka is that we would believe in our kids and empower them and do what we can to make sure that they get the education they deserve.
Thank you so much for speaking with us this evening.
Thanks, Lynn. It's good to be here. Happy Merdeka.
And to you. That was Chan Sinsing, CEO of Teach for Malaysia, talking to us about essentially what our education system could look like in 2040. And that's the question we've been asking you. What do you want Malaysia to be like in 2040? That number to call, 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899, tweet us at PFM Radio. And you know what? We've saved possibly the most complicated bit for the end, because up next, we're going to talk about Malaysian culture and identity and what that could look like Keep it here on Inside Story, BFM 89.9.
Bole for Malaysia. Ha. BFM 89.9, the business station.
It is just about 6:51 and you're listening to Inside Story with Lynn. We've been talking today about Malaysia, the next chapter, basically jumping ahead 19 years and asking what would Malaysia look like in 2040. And we are closing off by examining that from the point of view of our culture, our identity. Keep those thoughts coming. What would you like to see from Malaysia in 19 years? 20 years sounded catchier, but 2040 is a nice round number. So tell us. Now, joining us to talk about this issue of culture and identity is Natusha Naidu, president of Imagined Malaysia. Natusha, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for inviting me. It's a pleasure.
So let's start with the lay of the land, right? What encompasses Malaysian culture and identity for you right now in 2021?
I think for every Malaysian, when they try to define culture and what constitutes as Malaysian culture is always food, because we have such a diverse, cuisine, like such diverse cuisine that comes from just beyond Malaysia, right? And it has this really long histories and whatnot. And, you know, just our social practices and the traditions that we share, festivals. And I think a lot of this is where, very physical and very visual signs of Malaysia, that define Malaysian culture, right? But today, I think that Malaysians are starting to go beyond like the usual formula of muhibah and what they can see with their eyes, and are starting to think about how Malaysian culture is also about practices, the things we say, our attitudes and values, whether it's towards each other, our opinions on politics, race, religion, you name it. So yeah.
And I think, you hit the nail on the head there in saying that when it comes to trying to identify a singular identity, it's so difficult, right? Our country has so much diversity, very different lived experiences also depending on who you are, even where you were born within the country. How can we account for that when thinking about how we're going to continue to grow and change?
That's a really important question, because I think that a lot of times, even in like whatever nationwide campaigns for harmony, national unity, always tends to focus on trying to create this idea of sameness, right? Being the same, or a certain level of uniformity to being Malaysian. But this idea of like having different lived experiences shouldn't be seen as an obstacle to Malaysian identity. Rather, it's like those frictions and like ruptures in like Malaysian identity that actually really makes us Malaysian, that we have very complicated histories, but they're not necessarily running in parallel. They intersect all the time. And I think it's about overcoming that emphasis on differences and to actually go beyond and think more critically. And I think that's the conversation that Malaysians are right now getting more and more interested in. So it's it's actually a great time to be analysing and thinking about with Merdeka and all coming.
So the central question, how do you see our culture changing in the next 20 years? I mean, what would you like to see?
I thought about this question for a bit and I was not sure how to answer, because I wouldn't say I'm a cultural commentator, and I don't know about this idea of like putting forward like my vision of how Malaysian culture should be. But what I can say, like in my opinion, is that I think that I would like to see this more democratic and trans-ethnic kind of way of looking at Malaysian culture. Because, for so many years and decades, we've been so preoccupied with race and the question of race. And I think that people are getting a bit tired of it, to be honest. And maybe like what we're going to see is that people are going to find ways and a new kind of language to actually articulate and normalize, so that they think of Malaysianness as more than just about the conversation about what your race is.
And do you have thoughts, I guess, on what we could do to change that kind of narrative? Because I think you're absolutely right that race and religion continue to be hot button issues, and also that people are getting increasingly tired and want to move away from it. How do you think that shift away is going to happen?
I'm glad that you asked that question, because right now, Imagined Malaysia is working with IDEAS, the Institute for Democracy and Economic Affairs, on a campaign called hashtag Tanpa Perkauman, an anti-racist history of Malaysia. So if you go to our social media platforms, we've been producing two infographics weekly, available in Bahasa Malaysia and in English. And these infographics actually discuss how to talk about race in a more healthy and productive way, and to actually like do that thinking about solidarity and relationships between Malaysians and non-Malaysians in this country beyond like whatever we've known. And this is by narrating and looking back in the history of Malaysia, post-colonial and pre-colonial, even going back to like the Malaccan Sultanate. And I think that it's a very useful resource. We've had our teachers tell us that they've been using it in classroom settings, lecturers in you know, in universities for seminars. And I think like this is an attempt to try to move away from that by talking about it in a way that doesn't reinforce those categories, but rather question and destabilize how hard or solid they might be, to see that we actually share a lot more in common, or we have very intricate and complicated histories that we need to appreciate.
Natasha, we just have about a minute left with you. What are your hopes for Malaysia in 2040? What and who do you hope that we've become?
That Malaysia actually becomes a healthy parliamentary democracy that has that is rooted in racial equality and social justice. That's my hope in 2040.
And before you leave us, I thought you could tell us again where we can find that resource you were talking about.
Okay, so please take a look at Imagined Malaysia's Instagram account or Facebook, IMAGINEDMALAYSIA. And you can look at all our infographics, and we link it to the Malay version as well, which is published on IDEAS website and social media accounts.
Cool. Natasha, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
That was Natasha Naidu, president of Imagined Malaysia, talking to us about what we might look like culturally and in terms of our identity in 2040, which is the theme of today's show, right? That's what we've been asking you. So keep those thoughts coming. What would you like to see in Malaysia in 2040? That number to call, 7733 2900, WhatsApp 018-789-8899. Tweet us at BFM Radio. This has been Inside Story, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.